Dr. Rama Chandran, the Sherlock Holmes of modern neurology, is quoted as saying, "Don't polish the brass on the bandwagon. Walk or run in the other direction." Today's guest, Dr. Norman Doidge, discusses researchers like the brilliant Dr. Rama Chandran, who literally, through the use of mirrors, has been the first to amputate a phantom limb that can cause unstoppable pain, until now, that is. Dr. Doidge's book, The Brain That Changes Itself, relates stories of personal triumph from the frontiers of science. I really urge you to stay tuned. I'm Robin Clare. This is Tributaries. Dr. Doidge, I'd like to thank you for delivering this amazing information from a few scientific and medical journeys to the public in your book, The Brain That Changes Itself.
Thank you.
Maybe we can dive into brain plasticity by discussing how, after all the years of scientific research and science students ending up sometimes disproving their mentor's theory, isn't it interesting how the old school still likes to hang on?
Well, it has for a long time, but actually it's increasingly not. I think that in the last few years, there's just been this tidal shift. The findings in the hard scientific research are so persuasive. The experiment has now been done so many times, really thousands and thousands of times, in different ways showing that plasticity exists, that there are very few people who are at this point objecting in theory to plasticity. In other words, they accept the fact of it. Those who are still holding on, in a way, are people who haven't thought through the implications of the fact that the brain is plastic. And let me just define plasticity for your listeners. It's really just the property of the brain that allows it to change its structure and its function through mental experience. Now, that's not infinite change. It's not infinitely malleable. The people that I describe who change their brains, the brain that changes itself, had to, in general, work very hard. But still, it's very significant change. But when a revolution of this magnitude, and I've been arguing that this is the most important change in our understanding of the brain in 400 years, when a revolution of this magnitude occurs, it occurs over time. It takes a long time for people to begin to integrate and rethink the implications in, you know, the clinical sphere, in their day-to-day lives, because so much of how we've thought about the brain has been based on the notion that prevailed for about 400 years, which was that the brain was best understood as like a machine with parts, each part each part performing a single mental function in a single location in the brain. And, of course, that idea is with us whenever we talk about the brain as though it's a computer. And when we talk about the brain as being fundamentally hardwired, hardwiring is just a kind of an electronic machine metaphor, which basically says that the circuits in our brains are genetically predetermined and formed and finalized in childhood so that they don't really change after a certain point. And that notion, you know, you can read about that in the paper, this and that is hardwired. Now, it's not that nothing in the brain is hardwired ever. I'm not arguing that. But the idea that the brain is fundamentally, irrevocably hardwired is not only wrong, it's actually spectacularly wrong, because that's actually, in very large measure, how the brain does its work, by actually changing its wiring.
Now, why are you saying that there are some things that are hardwired in the brain? I find that curious, because so much has been disproved as to being worked from a certain location, and so much of the hardwiring has turned into a myth, really. What is the place where you would say this piece is hardwired, for instance?
Well, okay. You know, I've never met a human being who doesn't have an autonomic nervous system with a fight or flight system in it, and a parasympathetic system to turn that off. So the existence of that system you know, seems to be in some ways or other. I mean, hardwiring is a metaphor, remember? It's wiring and hard.
Yes.
But if you just understand it as a metaphor. But the existence of that system seems to be in everybody. And so, there's a certain degree of connectivity in that. And there are many other things that are comparable to that. I'm not a relativist, and I'm not arguing that the brain is infinitely plastic. Plasticity itself, for instance, is something that I do believe is universal, so every human being has it to some degree, to a significant degree. But, you know, let's just take the autonomic nervous system as one. There are parts of the brain that seem to move around less than other parts. But that much being said, my point is that there are many aspects of the autonomic nervous system. So that's the part of you that in an emergency goes into fight or flight. And the parasympathetic system is the part of you that turns that off and makes you feel relaxed. That there are many aspects of those systems that we thought were hardwired that are not. So there's nothing magical about what I'm talking about, although it seems reminiscent of magic when you start describing the kinds of changes people can do. You still have to study brain anatomy. It still happens to be the case that, you know, the fear system is in the limbic system in human beings and so on and so forth. So, but I don't want to try to challenge one overstatement, which said that the brain of every person past the age of, let's say, 14 or 15 is completely hardwired, with an equally immoderate counterstatement.
Understood.
Everything is plastic all the time. I mean, put simply, if everything was plastic all the time, why would there be so many books on the market about change? Change is very hard to do for human beings. The whole self-help industry is based on the fact that it doesn't come easy to change oneself. So it's pretty clear that, you know, that the human brain is a balance of change and stability, and in fact it has to be. If your brain was infinitely plastic, you would not be you, 5 seconds into, the conversation. You have changed to become someone else.
Yes. Do you feel that fear, you just mentioned fear, do you feel like it's an essential element for life?
Oh, yeah. There's things to be afraid of. I have a friend who, Jordan Peterson, is a very brilliant psychologist. And when a person comes into his practice and says, well, I'm really, really anxious, and I don't know why, and his response intellectually is, well, why wouldn't you be? There's a tremendous amount to be
That's very true.
Afraid of. There's, basically, we only know little bits of the whole of, of this universe that we live in. We don't know, in my opinion, we don't really have fundamental knowledge about the most important, biggest questions, such as what is consciousness? What is a thought? How was the universe created? We have theories. We don't really know. They keep changing. And how did life evolve? What's that spirit in, that takes, or whatever you want to call it, that takes carbon molecules and inanimate and turns it into the animate? Now, these are the most fundamental questions, but we also don't know what the weather is going to be like tomorrow and whether a war is going to break out and so on and so forth. There's tremendous, the mystery is why we're not anxious, given all that we have to deal with. And our brains are very good at making us not anxious.
Right.
So the fear system is just necessary for survival because it's the success of our society which has, in fact, deluded us into thinking that, life is easy. Life is filled with much suffering in reality. And the success makes us expect that it should always be easy. But, we evolve from situations where they're predator and prey, and sometimes we were preyed upon.
I would imagine
your system is to protect us in that situation.
I would imagine that the fact that you are also, as well as being a scientist and doctor, you're a poet. And I would imagine that that sort of helped you move through all of the research and the work you did in writing this book.
Well, actually, it did. I spent a lot of time before I went into medicine studying poetry and philosophy. And so, pardon me, when I started hearing, I mean, the reason I got into plasticity was complicated, but one of the reasons was, as a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst, I increasingly noted that as genetic determinism was rising as a force and a kind of discourse, particularly in the late 80s and 90s, when a patient with depression or anxiety didn't get better, you would increasingly hear colleagues saying, well, you know, I think these problems are hardwired into them. And the only problem was that when patients with those kinds of illnesses or disorders did get better, you never heard anybody say anything about hardwiring. And it was pretty clear to me that this was just a metaphor that was beginning to conceal more than it was revealing. And I was always somewhat dissatisfied on philosophical and intellectual grounds with the mechanistic metaphors about life. In fact, many of the neuroplasticians I worked with often described, you know, the cell as having machinery. This was a very big thing to do over the last, since cells were discovered. You know, there's basically four, you'd ask me, why do people hold on to the notion of the machine-like brain? And there are basically four reasons. The first reason is that we didn't have the ability to make microscopic movies of the brain in the, you know, in the act of changing. We could take kind of the equivalent of still photographs, and most of our brain scans were not microscopic. So basically, as we developed that in the 50s and 60s, and as they became widespread in the, you know, 80s and 90s, we were able to show it over and over again. The second reason is that the notoriously bad prognosis for people who had brain injuries. People who had brain injuries were assumed, it was assumed they would never get better. If a person had a stroke, for instance, they would get 6 weeks of rehab. Why 6 weeks? Well, when the stroke occurred, it was assumed the brain cells died, and the areas around those cells were inflamed or metabolically deranged, meaning there were chemical reactions responding to the injury. And you would wait 6 weeks till the inflammation and that metabolic derangement went down just to see what was left. And rehab wasn't really training the brain to do new things. It was rather priming the brain, or it's like turning, priming a pump that you haven't used for well water for a long time, just to get it going again and see what was left. And in fact, when people did get better, what we said was, well, they never really lost brain tissue in the first place. They just had some metabolic derangement. We explained away any people who improved. We just sort of thought they were lucky and they hadn't really had a serious stroke. Now, that's a big one because it caught, the question is, well, why did we do that? Why do we take that explanation and not another?
Well, it's a huge one, and the fact that the brain is plastic, and the fact that, as you mentioned in your book, in 1991, you were one of the few psychiatrists that were actually working from that place of the brain being plastic. So it's no wonder that the pharmaceutical industry had a heyday, really, because it's like, okay, well, there's nothing we can do, so let's do this. And that will perhaps just keep them status quo or something.
Well, the simplistic view of something like depression, plasticity exists at many, many different levels. One of the core plasticity experiments that has been most important, and was the reason I went to study at Columbia, was performed by Dr. Eric Kandel. Eric Kandel was a psychiatrist. He was very interested in Freud, but some of his analyst friends, when he was training, said, you know, you've got a real gift for experimentation. And psychotherapy, seems to us, is about learning. that was his mentor, Mortimer Austo, said that. And we really need to know more about learning. So what Austo did was, what Kandel did was, he found an animal that had a very, very large nervous system, a certain kind of snail, and was able to teach that snail various sort of typical Pavlovian kinds of responses, such as habituation, but basically learning. And he was able to show, because this nervous system was so large, that as the animal learned, it changed the number of connections between cells in its nervous system. And that was demonstrated, so people could watch this happening. And then Kandel, very brilliant, was able to go on and show that when learning occurs, the way it works is the learning activity actually causes the cell to turn on certain genes inside the cell to make new proteins to make those connections so that an animal could have, for instance, before it learned something, perhaps 1,300 connections between cell A and cell B, and that could double in about a four-hour training session. So learning basically turns on genes, and this is very remarkable. And Kandel was actually following something that Freud himself had speculated about. In the 1880s, this is a long time ago, Freud argued that when two events occur in consciousness simultaneously, the nerve cells that are processing those two different events, the two different groups of neurons processing those two different events, increase the connections between them. So he called this the law of association by simultaneity. We now say neurons that fire together wire together. And Kandel, about 100 years after Freud, basically demonstrated that happening. Now, as I said, neuroplasticity goes on at many different levels, but at one of the key levels is that mental experience can drive this change. Mental experience can be sensing and perceiving or acting or even at times imagining, doing certain actions. And when you get to a situation where you start to describe something like depression, which really exists at all levels of the nervous system, as merely existing at one level, saying, you know, it's a chemical imbalance, that's what it's all about. You are usually using another kind of machine metaphor. It's a chemical machine metaphor, which kind of says the drug that you're missing is like a key. The cell has a receptor, which is like a lock, and you're missing the key to go in that lock, and that's why you're depressed. Now, I don't deny that in depression there are abnormalities in, you know, levels of neurotransmitters. The issue is, well, what's causing those levels, and what's the best way to rectify the situation? And, it turns out that there are multiple ways to rectify the situation. And chemical substances, for some people, are one of the ways. But there are many, many ways you can intervene. And ideally, the treatment of depression should involve interventions at many levels, including the mental level. So even that sort of simplistic notion of depression is part of the machine-like metaphor. Now, here's where it comes from. It's important to understand that, because that's where the opposition to the idea of plasticity comes from. You know, human beings have roughly had three great ideas of nature that have been predominant throughout human history. The first one, you know, goes back to the ancient world, and in many respects, it goes back to the mythopoetic world, which often had creation stories that saw nature emerging from the body of some vast organism. The Chinese saw it as emerging from a large egg. There are ancient Near Eastern myths that saw a quarrel between the gods. A goddess was slain, and out of her body came all of nature. By the time you get to the pre-Socratic philosophers in ancient Greece, you have people like Thales, who says that the entire world is ensouled, and even rocks, certain sacred rocks, it's thought can have souls. And you have a kind of animistic view of the world where things that we think are dead and inanimate were thought by the ancients to be alive. And even some of the Greek philosophers saw the world as like a vast living organism. Now, that began to change with the later Greek philosophers, and it was that view basically was destroyed in the West by the rise of modern science and people like Galileo. The ancient Greeks and Romans would look to the heavens, see planets, and call them Mars and Venus and Jupiter. They saw them as very much like organisms, like human beings. But Galileo looked at those planets and saw them as matter in motion. They were depersonalized, or depersonified would be the correct term, or deanthropomorphized. And Galileo described the people around Galileo's time were smitten with these, what were called the mechanical laws of motion, or and a mechanistic view of the world that saw the universe as functioning like a cosmic clock. And people were so astounded by the predictions that Galileo could make and the new map he had given of the world just using matter in motion, mechanical laws of motion, that they started to describe the organs inside our bodies as though they were little machines inside us. And the first accomplishment of this new mechanistic biology was William Harvey, who worked, by the way, in the same institution as Galileo, who described the circulation of the blood, who described the heart as like a pump, and the blood vessels as having valves and so on. And in other words, he described with great success and great practical benefit the heart as though it was like a machine. And after that, the French philosopher René Descartes described the nervous system as a similar kind of machine. He thought our nerves were vessels, and a fluid bounced up and down those nerves, and currents ran up and down the nerves. And everything worked like these currents reflecting back and forth. He basically described the reflex for the first time. And so mechanistic science, mechanistic neuroscience was born, and that evolved into the modern model of the machine-like brain. And that was so powerful and so helpful in dealing with the brain in some respects, because when people first tried to look at the brain, it was just too complicated to figure out. So to think about it as a machine with parts and certain things happening in certain areas was helpful. And when Paul Broca in 1861 discovered that people who had strokes in the left frontal lobe lost the ability to speak, that was a great accomplishment, and that was the beginning of localizing what happens where. The problem was that although things tended to happen in certain areas, they didn't have to. And so we became smitten with this idea that, you know, each brain part can only do one thing, and if that area is damaged, nothing can be done. And what the neuroplasticians have been able to do is show that often, not always, but often when a certain area is damaged, an adjacent healthy area can take over and that the brain can reorganize itself.
Well, that certainly was shown when you talk about the frontotemporal lobe dementia of the left side. Oftentimes, all of a sudden, the person is amazingly artistic or creative in another way.
What seems to be, there are many examples of that, although not everyone with frontotemporal dementia has that.
Right.
Basically, that is a weird kind of dementia where only one hemisphere tends to be affected by the illness. And it's been observed by Bruce Miller and that in many cases, people who develop this dementia, and by the way, it's tragic. I mean, they really do lose their left functions, left brain functions, that certain right brain functions take over at a genius kind of level so that they can... People who were, you know, couldn't really draw can suddenly draw brilliantly, and they have certain kinds of poetic sound abilities emerge. And what we've learned from that, or so I argue, is that our the two different hemispheres of our brains, one of the things that they seem to do is inhibit each other. I sometimes say they're like an old married couple where she, you know, she says to him, you know, if you're going to the party tonight, I don't want you talking about politics anymore. All you do is, you know, make fun of yourself. And he says to her, well, I don't want you to bring up, you know, our daughter's religious conversion or something like that. Now, it's not uncommon that certain brain areas inhibit other brain areas. And when that inhibition is lost, then you see, you might see the emergence. So there is an element of reorganization, but you might see the emergence of an extraordinary ability. It's easy to romanticize that. I mean, these people do have dementia, and, you know, their brains do decline. But what we see there is something that, you know, there's a potential that we have that we end up blocking because of our development. And, you know, Betty Edwards, a number of years ago, based on split brain research, developed a technique to enhance drawing in her famous book, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. The whole thing you try to do there is you try to block the left hemisphere from blocking your right hemisphere from drawing. And I took the course, and I think it was an amazing experience. Everybody in the class improved, you know, many, you know, a massive amount. You know, I would say people who were doing quite pathetic drawings at the end of about a 40-hour week were doing magnificent drawings that, you know, were professional level. So,
well, that the roadblock technique, so to speak, has been used in many avenues for bringing someone back into wholeness or full working. And it's interesting how I wondered while I was reading your book, that's in a sense a resistance technique. And I wonder if you think there's a technique that does not work with resistance.
What do you mean by resistance technique?
Well, I think just by putting up a roadblock, it felt sort of like a resistance. But I guess maybe it isn't a resistance. Maybe it's just, you know, it's like, okay, well, we can't turn right here because they're working on the road. We're going to go left, and then we'll work our way around. It might take a little longer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how I see it. I mean, basically, plasticity. It's probably best to give an example, and so people can understand what we're talking about in a concrete way.
Thank you.
So I'll give you one, a dramatic one. Michael Bernstein was an eye surgeon, and in his mid-50s, he was an eye surgeon, a tennis buff. He played piano, and in his mid-50s, while on the tennis court, he had a devastating stroke. And one entire side of his body was paralyzed. He happened to be living in Birmingham, Alabama, and he got the conventional treatment, which was about 6 weeks. At the end of it, he had hardly any improvement, and was sent home and said, you know, this is it. You know, you can try a little stuff on your own, but this is basically where you're going to be. Now, in Birmingham, Alabama, Dr. Edward Taub,
hero,
was working, and Dr. Taub, originally doing work with monkeys, had made some very remarkable discoveries.
Thanks, Norman. We'll continue with Dr. Deutsch next week, author of The Brain That Changes Itself. In the meanwhile, for any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for the weekly notice of shows, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.